Welcome, welcome to Paradigm Shifters. Today, we have a wonderful paradigm shifter who's going to take your paradigm and shift it all over the place. At least that's where you live, Hank, isn't it? This is Hank Wesselman, who's a shaman and who's awakening to a shaman intelligence, if you want to call it that, or the multi-level intelligence. That's really been enchanting, hasn't it?
It has, you know, and to all of you out there listening, warm greetings from Hawaii Island. That's where I live. And it's
what a
raining,
wonderful nirvana, huh?
Well, you know, it looks a lot like Tahiti where I live. And I know it's tough, but somebody's got to live here.
But I think being an anthropologist and an evolutionary, what would you call it? Evolutionary anthropologist, right?
Yes, I am. And I'm also an evolutionary biologist because the research that I do in East Africa and the fossil beds with an international expedition is to reconstruct paleo environments of early man sites at the time they were laid down. And in order to do that, I often work with the fossil fauna. Specifically, the microfauna, the rats, the bats, the shrews, the hedgehogs, because they tend to be very habitat specific and they live very short lives in a very small home range. So if you can find them, I can tell a great deal about the environment of the site at the time it was laid down. So I spent a lot of time in the British Museum in London, the Museum of Central Africa in Belgium, the Museum of Central Africa in Paris, the Museum of Natural History, that is, and the museum in Addis in Ethiopia, South Africa, and so forth and so on.
But wait a minute, did you have visions at that time? Because isn't it wonderful to be visionary and to be looking back at fossils, as you say? Can you use your visions to apply to different levels of, human existence and consciousness?
Well, Veronica, you know, we don't want to really claim anything here.
Okay.
But the fact is that my project, my current project with the Middle Owash Research Project has been very successful. And, you know, things happen when I arrive in the field and we tend to make big discoveries. So, you know, I'm very grateful for any assistance I'm getting from the other side. But, you know, I wouldn't want to claim that I'm using magic to find things. You understand?
Mm-hmm, I sure do, yes. I guess what I was thinking is that sometimes we get feelings about different, you know, a lot of people. I don't think that's just magic. I think that humans have the ability to perceive on the emotional level a lot of times. Do we not?
We do. Mm-hmm. And for me, the interesting thing was that when I was with another research expedition in the lower Omo Valley back in the early 1970s, I would be in the safari camp for 3 months, you know, out 600 miles from the nearest cold beer or hot bath. You know, you know, it's one thing to go camping over Labor Day weekend and come home on Sunday night and have a shave and a shower. But, you know, it's quite different when you're out there for 3 months in the wild country among wild people, traditional tribal people, wild animals. And it was out there in those arid, whispering lands that I began to have visions. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I had no idea what they were. You know, I thought maybe they were fantasies, maybe they were hallucinations, but they were real and they got my attention. But I didn't know what to do with them at that time because, you know, although I'm an anthropologist and, you know, I knew something about shamans, I didn't really have any background. You know, these were not visions that I was looking for. You know, for example, I remember one day I was excavating a site. This is Indiana Jones' work, by the way.
Right.
And I do hope that before I make transition that I cross trails with Harrison Ford so that we can compare field notes. Anyway.
I think I told you once before the story of a fellow who was lost on a mountain and Harrison Ford does rescuing with helicopters. And the guy came to and saw what he thought was Harrison Ford helping him into this helicopter. And it was true. But he was going, wow, I'm having a vision. I'm having a hallucination. Isn't that something?
That would be really something. I would like that.
It's a great story. So,
on this particular day, I think it was in 1972, and it was around 115 in the shade, and there was no shade. So we were planning to go back to camp for lunch, and we were packing up the Land Rover. I say we because I had two African tribal men from Kenya, Wakamba tribesmen, working with me. And I had a local tribesman of the Dasnich tribe from the lower Omo Valley, north of Lake Turkana. And he was a shaman. People had told me he was a shaman. But, you know, in those days, well, let me put it this way. He spoke six languages, six tribal languages, but none of them was English. But I had a guy on my team who spoke Swahili very well. And Atiko, who was the shaman, spoke Swahili. And so I could communicate with him. But, you know, friendship has a language of its own. And we developed this interesting system of nonverbal communication in which I would need to have things happen, and they would just happen. He would just do them. But on this particular day, I remember getting this very odd feeling that I was being watched by something. Now, look, when you're 100 yards from the Land Rover, and there you know that there are lions, that there are leopards, that there are buffalo, that there are hyenas. You know,
snakes. This is, what about snakes?
Well, the snakes stick, you know, they're out at night. You have to watch for them when you go out for that middle of the night leak.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But, you know, here I was, and this feeling was really strong. So what I did is I stood up very slowly and I looked over the brim of my under the brim of my bush hat, and I scanned the surroundings very carefully. And as I shifted my eyes to my left, I saw something with my peripheral vision. It was big, and it was about 6 feet off the ground. And as I looked directly at it, it disappeared. It was as though there was a tear in the fabric of the air, and whatever it was stepped through that rip and then zipped it closed from the other side, leaving a momentary wrinkle that straightened out, and it was gone. I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, Hank, it's time to go back to Nairobi for a beer. Oh, I thought I was having hallucinations. So I look over at the shaman, and he's watching me. And I realized that he'd seen it. And I knew that he'd seen it, and he knew that I'd seen it, and I knew that he knew, and so forth.
Talk about infinity, huh?
The shaman is watching me very, very carefully. And I looked at him and I said in Swahili, Atiko, kwanini? And that means, Atiko, what was that? And he gave me a measuring look, and then he smiled, and he pointed at exactly the place where I'd seen this strange apparition, and he said a word in Swahili, Shaitani. That's the Swahili word for spirit. Now, in those days, I worshipped solely at the altar of science, and I wasn't sure I believed in spirits. So I just kind of stashed this memory. I wrote cryptic notes in my field journal, which only I would understand. You know, this isn't the sort of thing you share with your academic colleague.
No, I'm sure.
But, you know, this is when it began. Although it really began when I was a child in Central Park, when I, you know, in New York, when I saw squirrels and pigeons and trees, and I realized that they were living beings like myself, but they were different. And then there was the zoo in Central Park, where I had an encounter one day, which I didn't understand. I could have been more than 4 or 5 years old. But, you know, I remember coming into a big mammal house and seeing this extraordinary creature in a cage. And I'd never seen a leopard before. And For me, the words have always been among the most magnificent of creatures. And so I looked at this leopard and I realized that within this pacing, spotted form, a great will was imprisoned. So I looked at the leopard, and the leopard suddenly turned and looked into my eyes. And as it did, something happened. And suddenly the bars were gone, and we found ourselves in a blue place, a place of blueness, the leopard and myself. And, I have no idea what happened next, and I've been reaching for it, but it eludes me. This is part of the mystery, what I think of as the mystery. The mystery is elusive. That's why it's called the mystery. And it always is just right out there in front of us, and we never can quite grasp it. Because that's its nature. It's mysterious. But I think in retrospect, and from my perspective now in my late 70s, that the mystery's job is to draw us forward onto the path of our destiny.
Would you use the word enchantment or re-enchantment for the activation of that mystery that you had? Was
Indeed,
it, would you see it all as the same beautiful puzzle or the
I had an enchanted childhood. And it all went away, of course, when I hit puberty. And then here I was in my early 30s in Africa, and that's when it came back. Now, the interesting thing about this apparition I saw is that there were spots, and that didn't compute at all at that point. But 10 years later, when I was finishing my doctoral work in Berkeley, a friend of my wife's called up and she said to me, "Hank, there's an anthropologist coming to town. He's going to offer a workshop in shamanism. You're going to love it. It's just right up your alley." Well, I wasn't too sure because I was very busy, and the thought of spending the weekend with a bunch of flaky New Agers appealed to me.
But Hank, why did she think it was appropriate for you?
Well, she knew me. She saw my mystical side, I think. And that mystical side has always been there. So I think it was the memory of that elusive something that happened in Africa 10 years before. And that memory got me to the workshop. And the workshop was taught by an anthropologist named Michael Harner. And I know that many of your listeners are aware of who Michael Harner was.
You
Passed.
bet.
He
He
passed.
passed this year, did he?
Well, he was one of the major figures in the resurgence of interest in shamanism in the Western world. And here I was in a workshop with him, and I wasn't getting all that good results in my journey work. Shamanic journey work is a form of meditation. And I wasn't getting all that good results, but the last day of the workshop, we were teamed up with another person, a partner. And the job of each journeyer was to find a helping spirit for the other. And we did them one at a time. So here I am lying on my back in the dark with Michael Horner blamming away on his drum. And the woman I was teamed up with was Sandra Ingerman. Now, Sandra Ingerman is very well known today. But at that time, I had no idea who she was. I knew she was a graduate student in counseling psychology at the CIIS in San Francisco. And I was a graduate student in anthropology at Berkeley. And so I'm lying on my back, and she's lying next to me on the floor, and she's journeying into the other world to find a helping spirit for me. And I'm feeling some anxiety. What if she doesn't find anything? But in the middle of the journey, she sits up suddenly in the dark and looks at me very fiercely. And then she leans over and plants her face on my chest and starts blowing into my heart. Well, there are zings that are going up and down my spine. There's goosebumps all the way down to my knees. Something is happening, but I don't know what it is. And then she sits me up and blows into the top of my head. Same response. Then at the end of the journey, when the lights come on again, she tells me about her adventure in which she journeyed into what shamans call the lower worlds, the worlds below this one. This is the middle world, the world that we live in. So she was journeying down into the lower worlds, which are the dream worlds of nature. You know, if you want to connect with the spirit of eagle or the spirit of hawk or the spirit of mountain lion or the spirit of unicorn, for that matter, you journey into the lower worlds because that's where they are. So,
and it can be a mythical being, can it?
It could be. I mean, it could be a dragon. Wow. It could be a griffin. This is where they came from into human conscious awareness. You see, in our realm, they're mythic, but in the lower world, they're real.
That's wonderful news.
That's wonderful news. So she's journeyed into the lower world, and she describes encountering a being who said it was one of my old friends who wanted to come back into my life once again. And then she describes the leopard spirit.
Wow.
I called him the leopard man because he used to stand up on his back legs, mimicking the way I stand up on my back legs. And so...
And he was a real buddy when you were small, was he not?
He was. It was kind of like Calvin and Hobbes. You know, those of you who remember that wonderful cartoon strip, Hobbes was a tiger and Calvin was a little boy. And they would have adventures together. And every once in a while, there would be a panel that would give the game away that Hobbes was really a stuffed animal. But for Calvin, Hobbes was very real. And this is what it was like for the leopard man. When the leopard came into my life at the zoo, it became my secret friend. Interestingly, it didn't like to come into the apartment building where I lived. It stayed in the bushes in the park. You know, leopards are ambush hunters. And I didn't know anything.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know anything about them either at that point. But whenever I would go to the park with my au pair or my mother, the leopard man would appear in my mind and we would have adventures together. And of course, I never told anybody about this.
How wonderful.
So when Sandra Ingerman came up and described the leopard man to me, this got my attention.
I imagine, yeah.
To say the least. Mm-hmm. And that was really the beginning of my re-enchantment, although it did begin in East Africa, when I would have these visionary experiences. And I've described some of these in my current book, The Re-Enchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder, which people are really enjoying. I've done a lot, you know, recorded a lot of my field notes, so to speak, in this book. And
it's delightful. It's a book I want to be in when I'm reading it. I'm in it, you know.
Well, I'm glad you like it.
I do, yeah. And it also activated some of my own visions, enchantments, whatever you call it. So thank you.
The re-enchantment. You know, I have the sense that all of us are really enchanted beings. But the fact is that we're so distracted by the power of our material world, that most of us miss the subtle stuff as it passes through. And it tends to come through very quickly. You know, you've got to be paying attention. And most people are not paying attention. You know, they're concerned with, you know, money, with power, with status, sex. And, you know, this is typically the these are typically the motivating factors for people of younger soul age. It tends to be people of older soul age who get into mysticism. Sometimes it happens very early when we're children, and sometimes it happens later in midlife or even in elderhood. For me, it came back in my 30s, and my life has never been the same since.
But it's, you're grateful. It's like having more than one dimension that you're actively living in, isn't it?
You know, the shaman is somebody who has one foot in this world and one foot in the other world. You know, the indigenous people, the tribal people of the world, see the world as being made up of two halves. There's the world of things seen and the world of things hidden. and they make no distinction between them. They understand that they present themselves together, mixed into one common reality. Now, the shaman is the one who can see into the world of things hidden. And when we use the word shaman in the Western world, most of us tend to conjure up an image of a masked and tribal person, you know, dancing around the fire in the dark, involved in some mysterious ritual, accompanied by drum beats or rattling.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good description. But inside that cultural shell of costume, mask, and ritual, there's an individual who has a very real set of skills. All true shamans are able to achieve altered states of consciousness, or we could call them expanded states of awareness, in which they can re-geography their conscious awareness into the world of things hidden. And when they do, they discover, the first thing they discover is that this other world is inhabited. It's inhabited by transpersonal forces that they call spirits, like the spirit of eagle, the spirit of bear, or maybe the higher organizing intelligences, like the angelic forces.
So transpersonal only refers to something that will connect, some being that will connect you from your three dimension to other. Is that right?
That's true. Now, you know, those of us in the Western world, I believe that this is one of our birthrights.
Mm-hmm.
Ability to vision, because this is a visionary tradition. The ability to vision is one of our birthrights. The problem is, it's like a muscle. If you don't use it, you lose it.
And we don't use it when it isn't even acceptable, right?
Well, most of us have imaginary friends when we're children.
Sure.
And those imaginary friends are usually spirits of one form or another who help us through the perils and pains of childhood. And it's interesting. I remember when I was teaching at UC San Diego in La Jolla, I was talking to the woman in our anthropology department who handled all the grants and the money. And she was a very professional person. But I got to know her pretty well. And one day I asked her, did you ever have an imaginary friend when you were a little girl?
Good for you.
And she stopped. And I watched her look within. Usually when you ask somebody a question and they look down, they're looking within themselves. If you ask somebody a question, they look from side to side like this. They tend to be waiting for the auditory. Or if they look up, they're looking into visual realms.
Huh.
Into visual realms.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
It's very helpful.
Well, you know, I'm very visual. And those of you who've read my Spirit Walker trilogy, for example, are aware of just how visual I am and how I can bring back, you know, visual imagery and record it in a written form, which is what I did in those books.
Hmm.
Other people are auditory. I think of them as audios. I'm a visual. They're audios, like musicians. I mean, how do you remember a whole symphony or a quartet, a string quartet?
That's true, yeah. Hmm.
Comes through in blocks through the auditory channel. Actors as well. I mean, how do you remember a whole Shakespearean play when you're on stage? It comes through the auditory channel.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are those who are somatic in the way in which they access. Somatic refers to the body.
Mm.
Information just comes to them. A lot of psychics fall into this category, mm-hmm. where they just know things.
Mm-hmm.
It comes to them. And a surprising number of people fall into this category. So,
have it all. Some have all those, you know.
Some do.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to, although the auditory is small. I remember once I was on a heiau, a temple platform in Hawaii. These are what remains of the old Hawaiian religion. They tend to be great big platforms of stone, which are usually rectangular. although they can be circular. And I was up on this hayal. The hayals were usually built over places of dense power that are concentrated in the ground. This involves geomancy. And there are masters of geomancy, kahuna of geomancy.
That's like ley lines and vortexes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, here I was on this platform, and I looked down, and I saw this stone that was shaped just like a fish. So I reached down, you know, being an archaeologist type person, you know, I'm always walking around looking down at the ground. When I take people to Egypt, every photograph has me looking down at the ground. You know, so I pick up this stone that looks like a fish, and suddenly this voice in the King's English appears in my mind. I'm a fish god. Put me down.
Whoa.
Around. I mean, there is nobody around me. I'm completely alone. So I put the stone down. You know, that's
Did
a,
you
that's,
drop it or carefully lay it down?
Very carefully, yeah. Yeah.
Respectfully.
So I really think that the ability to vision is one of our birthrights. And if I've got this right, and I believe I do, Veronica, I believe that there's a program on our inner hard drive. I'm talking about our genetic code, our DNA. I think we're born with it. And when that when that program is double-clicked with the right mouse, like the drum, or the riddle, or the song, or the dance, or the yoga, or the exercise,
or the breathing, or
when it's double-clicked with the right mouse, it allows consciousness to expand dramatically, in which we can perceive in a way which is not possible in our ordinary waking state of consciousness. I believe this is one of our birthrights. And once you
discover, you believe it's kind of there for everyone, only we need to figure out what the double click is, right?
That's right. And like most genetic programs, it's expressed variably in the population. You know, some people just can't do it. They tend to be the real mentalists, you know, the linguists and the mathematicians and the philosophers. You know, I don't mean to, you know, say bad things about them, but they're so focused in the mental soul that they just can't shift down into the physical body soul. This is one of the things that we explore in workshops. When I was working in Hawaii, I discovered that the Kahuna mystics of Hawaii understand that we have not one, but three distinct souls.
Oh, really? I like that.
A spiritual soul, which is immortal, which is the source of who and what we are when we come into life. A physical body soul that we receive from mom and dad, you know, in the same way that the sperm and the eggs, the gametes, have a genetic program, half from the father, half from the mother, that comes and creates a new template. There's also a spiritual, psychic, energetic program, half from the mother, half from the father. So this lower soul, the physical body soul, is actually the aspect of ourself that visions. And people who are very, very focused here have a hard time shifting gears down into the lower soul and learning how to do it. But you know,
can I just intrude just for a minute of my own story, which is I'm a pretty good psychic, actually. But for me to break into it, took some trauma. When trauma happened, then it broke. But it's funny, I went into it because I'm kind of linear sometimes in certain aspects, but it was like there was a membrane that broke and I got to go through it. Isn't that funny? And oftentimes that's how I get to the next level. Does that make any sense to you?
Sure does. Because, you know, this is how it began for me. You know, I wasn't looking for visions in the desert in Ethiopia. They came to me. And those of who've read the book Spirit Walker, you know, Spirit Walker is the book about how I really came into this work. And the first chapter records my encounter with what traditional tribal people would call a spirit. Now, I was on the heels of a joyous marital encounter in the middle of the night in Berkeley. And as I'm relaxing and about to go back to sleep, suddenly this feeling came into my body, this incredible feeling of soaring or force. It's like that feeling you get on a swing. Remember when we were children swinging down and up into that heady arc? You know, there was this rush of feeling that came into your body. Well, this is what I felt. And looking back on it now, that feeling roared into my body as I'm lying in bed next to my wife. And within moments, my physical body was completely paralyzed.
Oh, wow.
I was stiff as a stick of wood. I couldn't close my hands. And my vision came up, and I found myself standing in a forest in the dark. And, okay, here is my body lying in bed next to my wife. And visually, I'm seeing this forest at night in the dark. And, you know, curiously, I could hear my wife turning the pages of her book. She was reading a book. And
were you alone in the forest?
I was, well, I thought so. But as I was, I discovered that my thoughts would take me here and there. If I wanted to go someplace, I would go there. I would kind of float. I wasn't too sure what I was floating on or how I was walking or if I was walking. But I found myself face to face in that visionary state with what traditional tribal people would call a spirit. And this was a huge dark form, a huge dark spirit. In fact, you know, on my desk here, which is, you know, one big fat altar with my computer on it, I have a wooden carved image which resembles this spirit.
It's beautiful.
Now, imagine something like that, 50 feet tall, looking down at you. And in my case, it was completely black. There was no arms, no legs. And it was looking down at me. And
even though it's relatively small right now, I felt awe.
Well, I was only about this big, and it was this big. Now, for most people, they would probably go into fear. Okay, people who are psychologically Christian might be inclined to say, "Hey, get thee behind me, Satan," and go into fear. Well, I think this was a kind of test, because if you go into fear, the doorways remain closed.
Okay.
I'm talking about the doorways to the zone of magnified power. And because I went into awe and curiosity, I was shown the existence of energy, the existence of power, which was beyond my wildest imaginings. Suddenly, the term ecstasy took on an entirely new meaning. This spirit picked me up off the ground, rotated me in space, and I had lightning flashing off my fingertips.
Wow, wonderful.
Off my shoulders.
Whoa.
And I didn't see it. And I'm just absolutely soaring on this incredible force. I suddenly understood what Obi-Wan Kenobi called the Force.
Wow.
I was shown the existence of the Force. And then I think it was some sort of test, because I was put down on the ground again. And slowly the entire vision faded. And I found myself back in bed next to my wife again, with these feelings of energy slowly just departing. This was the first real vision.
Did you have any little pieces of green from the forest on you?
What is it?
Did you have any little pieces of green or leaves from the forest on you when you came to?
No, but you know, when you've had, you know, it's one thing to listen to other people's experiences.
Sure.
It's one thing to read about them. It's one thing to hear some visionary talk at a bookstore. Mm-hmm. But when you have the awesome jolt of the real thing, with one of these transpersonal forces on its home ground, it changes you, and life is never the same again. This was the beginning of an extraordinary series of visions, which is, you know, recorded in the Spirit Walker trilogy, Spirit Walker, Medicine Maker and Vision Seeker, three books.
I will be reading those. And did you find that they carved a trail for you, the visions? Did they have a sort of themes or, you know, access to a bigger and bigger consciousness?
This is where it gets sticky. Mm-hmm. They did. I found myself experiencing the same paralysis, the same feelings of incredible energy, and I found my conscious awareness being drawn out of my physical body. And I would find myself traveling along a line of light in this great spider web of light against a dark field. And I would kind of black out. And when my conscious awareness came on again, I was in somebody else's body.
Oh, wow. Now that is exciting. Did you like it or was it scary? No, you didn't get afraid, right?
I'm a trained scientist. Mm-hmm. Nothing prepared me for this experience. Mm. And I was in this man's body. He was totally unaware of the fact that I was there. It was like there were two of us, him and me, in one physical body. Mm-hmm. And I had access to his thoughts, his memories, his world. I could see his world through his eyes. And what makes this really sticky is that this is a man who is not a past life. He's a future life. He's a man who lives in the future. To be precise, he lives approximately 5,000 years after the collapse of Western civilization. Hmm. Now, this threw me into a psychological crisis. You know, I didn't know what to do with this. I thought I might be losing my marbles.
But Hank, is he you? I mean, did you decide finally that he's you or your soul?
This happened much later. I continued to have these connections with him. Now, this is a man of Hawaiian ancestry, but he doesn't live in Hawaii. He lives on the western coast of North America. Hmm. In a place which is completely different from what we see today. For example, the Central Valley of California, if this is California, mm-hmm. is filled with a marine inundation, kind of like Puget Sound. Mm. The land is covered with rainforest, with iguanas and jaguars and monkeys and parrots, you know, flying through the air.
And you could see it all.
I could see it all.
Wow.
I could see it all. And I have access to this guy's memories. And this guy is a clerk who works for the chief of his land division. And he's very interested in what happened to the once great American civilization. And at the beginning of this series of journeys, he was leaving his community and engaging in a quest of geographic investigation into the interior of the lost continent of America.
Wow. So he's kind of an anthropologist.
Listen, you know, this was really something. I would continue every 3 or 4 months or so to have one of these dreamlike visions in which I would merge with him while he engaged in this long walk into the interior of the continent. Wow. And he was looking for two things. He was looking for what happened to the rest of the American people on the one hand, and he was also interested in horses, because when these people of Hawaiian ancestry arrived on the coast of Western North America, as I recall, it was 5, 6, 7 generations before he was born, they came in a fleet of double-hulled canoes, and they brought goats and calves and lambs with them on these double-hulled canoes. But horses they couldn't bring from Hawaii. And so one of the theories is that there might be horses in the interior of the country, because the great inland sea, as he calls it, is surrounded by tropical forests of really impressive dimensions.
Wow.
But, you know, he's walking across this incredible landscape, seeking connection with the interior of the country, which has never been visited by anybody in his community before. And I check in with him periodically along this incredible quest. And eventually he ends up in what we would call today Western Nevada. Hmm. He finds the remains of the once great North American population. Now, I'm not going to go into that because I think I would be spoiling the story for people who would find it very interesting to read this.
Has it been written yet, or is that the next book?
Well, the next book is called Medicine Maker, and that's about how this man became a medicine man and a shaman, and how I became a medicine man and a shaman. And, you know, I say that with a lot of humility, by the way. Usually people who are authentic shamans never call themselves shamans.
Okay.
But since you've already done so, you know, I could say that although I don't call myself a shaman, I would call myself a shamanist. You know, those who follow the path of the Buddha don't call themselves Buddhas, although they are. They call themselves Buddhists.
Okay.
And those who follow the way of the Tao call themselves Taoists. So I think that those of us who follow the ancient path of the shaman could call ourselves shamanists and get away with it.
I like that. I want to shift just a minute to take another big perspective.
Okay.
As a shamanist, right? You're an anthropologist, evolutionary anthropologist. I want to ask if you feel that there's a wave of evolution moving through our species and you happen to be catching a higher percentage or talent in that wave, but do you think that's happening to evolve our species? Do you think it's a part of the growth of our species, or do you think it's just an is that's been there since time began?
Well, the answer is yes.
Both sides?
You know, as somebody who's involved in the quest for the mystery of human evolution, I've been involved in this field for 40 years.
Yeah,
and
so
I would say that after several million years of the evolution of body and brain, that the next stage of human evolution will be the evolution of consciousness.
Okay, good. We want that. Will we stop being a warring planet?
Again?
Will we stop being a warring species?
Oh, this is a tricky question.
It's a tricky question.
You know,
but it's a heart question.
2.5 million years ago, there was a very early form of proto-human called Australopithecus. And as far as we know, they lived around the margins of lakes and rivers where there were very dense forests in which they were essentially eating a diet much like those of chimpanzees, fruits, vegetation, and so forth and so on. But about 2.5 million years ago, there was a climate shift. The Ice Age began in the northern and southern halves of the world, and in the tropics, everything became very dry,
mm-hmm.
and those great forests shrank. So one of these early kinds of human had to make their living differently, and there was actually a great deal of food out on these expanding grasslands.
Okay.
Meat.
Aha.
And there was a period of time for maybe 500,000 years when we start to find these sharp stones, cracked river cobbles. We find the bones of carnivores with cut marks on them.
Hmm.
And we went through a scavenging phase where we were scavenging these big game kills, going in and cutting off as much as we could before the lions made a meal of us. You know, we would take this meat back to a place of safety to consume it. Now, something very interesting happens the minute we begin to include meat in the diet. The brain suddenly does this. It begins to expand. And over the next million years, the brain literally triples its size. And humans move into the hunting niche. We became the first primate predators, and we were good at it. We were ambush hunters like the leopard.
Wow.
We have been hunter-gatherers for about, I would say, probably about 2 million years.
Hmm.
And part of that, you know, this is a very tricky question to answer. The fact that we're predators gives us a kind of edge to our personality, towards our social systems. You take a look at the world today and look at what we're investing in their military budget.
Oh.
You know, you look at America the Beautiful, and out of the 246 years we've existed as a political entity, there are only 12 years when we have not been at war.
Wow.
America is essentially a war culture. Now, how did that happen? Well, the fact is that primates tend to be very territorial.
Hmm.
Look at baboons, for example. The big male baboons have enormous canine teeth, and their job is to defend a territory, you know, a home range. And they're very good at it. They are very tough customers.
Mm-hmm.
If chimpanzees, for example, they get into these terrible fights with other bands that go on for 45 minutes, in which they will essentially obliterate a rival male. And this was studied by a Harvard anthropologist named Richard Wrangham, who worked with Jane Goodall.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
The last 40 years or so, he worked on her chimpanzees. And at one point, he wrote a book with one of his students. And the title of the book is Demonic Males.
Woof.
Ape Behavior and Human Evolution.
Wow.
And what this book reveals is that by nature, we're violent, especially the males. There is a gender problem when you're talking about marital abuse, when you're talking about war, when you're talking about gangs. There is a violence problem.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with our genetics. I think we're programmed as males to be that way. And of course, some women can be this way as well.
But wait a minute, you were talking about the evolution, and we have to end this, unfortunately. I could talk to you forever. But this consciousness, the evolution of consciousness, isn't it going to push through that kind of relentless, you call it maleness, you know?
I believe that we can, but we have to choose it.
Okay.
This is the chooser. I'm talking about your mental soul, your ego. Your ego is the aspect of yourself, which traditional people would think of as a soul aspect, your mental soul, which we develop in each life in response to life as we live it.
Mm. But you used the word power earlier. Isn't there kind of an interesting unfoldment of what that word can mean, whether it's something innately within or something power over in a kind of combative way? You know what I'm saying? Is like, that's a very interesting word as well, which you used in the shamanist approach.
Well, you know, back about 40 years ago, there was a wonderful book that came out about hunting gathering people called Man the Hunter.
Aha.
And if you look at the way societies are set up, like our own, men tend to be hunters. They're hunters of money. They're hunters of status. They're hunters of power. They're hunters of girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
Women tend to be gatherers. They're gatherers of family. They're gatherers of husbands. They're gatherers of children. You know, men
techniques to help each other, sort of thing.
Yes, that's the way we tend to be programmed. And so in order to reprogram human behavior, it's going to take a great deal of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that
and choice, like you said.
The mental soul is the aspect of ourself that thinks, analyzes, integrates, makes decisions, practices discernment. The mental soul is the source of our creative imagination, the source of our intentionality, the source of our will forces. Now, you and I have heard countless numbers of spiritual teachers say things like, you've got to get rid of your ego.
I know.
Ego. Yeah. Now, do you think you should get rid of your ego based on what I just told you?
No.
Absolutely not.
No. But I think how we use it is a little less, we can use it very differently, refine it, define it. It's like power, right?
That's it, precisely. We're here to develop the ego.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Monroe said that in his book, Journeys Out of the Body.
Oh, I love that book.
It's required reading. He said, we're not here to drop the ego. We're actually here to develop an ego, because at the end of life, when we drop the body, the ego survives. So does the subconscious. Mm-hmm. So does the superconscious. And this composite of three souls, which come together to create the self in each life, they make transition as a personal pattern into the other world. And eventually they return to their source.
I love that, actually. I work with a lot of spirits myself. I have to unfortunately say goodbye, Hank Wesselman. And you are so interesting. And this is just tapping the beginning of some pretty interesting explorations. So
well,
would you like
to live up to that.
Pardon me? What's that?
I'll try to live up to that.
You are. That's a good way to put it. Living up to that. You're living up to that, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah.
And I might add that this series of visions, this connection with this man who lives in the future, they went off for about 7, 8, 9 years, and then they came on again.
Wow.
So back in touch with him. And he regards me as the source of incredible information. For example, when we're merged, he taps my mind for lost knowledge about the past.
Nice.
And I tap his mind for knowledge about the future.
And that's well, interesting because that reminds me of a question I asked you earlier, which was in your work with old fossils and so on, do you get wisdom and do you get memory kind of information? So it's a similar equation, not quite the same, but that you get to tap, he gets to tap the past through you. You are a fossil.
I have a very unusual life.
I think it's just wonderful.
You know, people sometimes come up to me. I got on a plane recently in Honolulu, and the guy who was checking me in looked at my name on my boarding pass and said, "Are you Hank Wesselman?" I said, "Sometimes."
Tell people how to get hold of you, Hank Wesselman.
Yeah, he'd read Spirit Walker, and he was just thrilled to meet me. So this does happen from time to time. And, of course, there are the workshops. You know, I travel around, and if you go to my website, sharedwisdom.com, there's a D in there, sharedwisdom.com. Mm-hmm. You can see what I do and where I go and the events that I'm involved in and so forth and so on.
And how to be in touch with you.
This is a good thing.
I'm really grateful that you joined us today. And I know a lot of people are going to enjoy this discussion that we've had. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Veronica. Blessings on you and your work.
Thank you. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you for tuning in to Paradigm Shifters. Isn't it wonderful to work on the cutting edge of the paradigm with some wonderful guests? Thanks so much, Hank Wesselman.
Okay. Aloha.
Aloha.